Hello, everybody. I'm happy to be able to talk to you again. It's been a little while. It's been quite a busy winter, what with flus and operations on my eyes and looking kind of like an Easter egg for a while. In fact, I was saying that for a while there, if I had been in a beauty contest with Boris Karloff and Frankenstein's monster, I'd have finished a distant third. But now I'm starting to look almost human again, and it's been wonderful to have people over here. I'm so glad that a number of you will still be coming this year, and I look forward to your visits. I've been thinking a lot lately about what our whole mission is. It began because I suggested to Dave Warner that we try putting the book that I'm writing on the comparison of the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita on the internet. And he wrote and said, well, what sequence shall we have? And I was thinking, well, obviously we should begin from the beginning. And then it dawned on me that there really hadn't been a beginning yet. It needed an introduction. And so I wrote an introduction, and it took quite a bit of work, but it was really a wonderful thing for me. I think whatever you do, you get more out of it than anybody else because you're sort of at the source. What it did for me was help to bring into focus what this entire mission is all about. Obviously, when the masters are born, they come into this world to help us find God. That's what it's really all about. But there's always a special context for their mission. It isn't always just that. There's an external part to it. So when Babaji he began this mission by giving the Kriya Yoga initiation to Lahiri Mahashay and telling him that this could be something that everybody could receive if they were sincerely desirous of it. And then he gave to Sri Yukteswar the job of comparing the scriptures of the East and the West to help people to see that the basic truths are one. And in fact, Master told us that Babaji had appeared, or Jesus had appeared to Babaji, and said his own church needed help. He said that they're doing good work in service and so on, but they've lost the essence of my mission, which was communion with God. And in fact, I've been reading a lot of the, not a lot, but some about the old Gnostic writings, and they emphasize that aspect, but the institutionalized church managed to finally get rid of that, or so they thought, but they didn't realize that even in the Bible that they approved of and published, there was a great deal of emphasis on personal communion with God, going within, the kingdom of God is within, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Many things that Jesus said that are in the Gospels are entirely in tune with the Gnostic writings. What are not in tune with them are all the external emphasis. And of course, a lot of those Gnostic writings are not necessarily genuine expressions of high realization. So it's a mixed bag. But the real teaching of Jesus was inner communion. And so Babaji was asked by Jesus to send someone to the West. And he sent Master to Sri Yukteswar to promulgate this teaching. But it was on several levels that he did it. He wanted to not Indianize the West, as I've mentioned many times. He wanted to spiritualize it. And he didn't want to make it a cultural exchange so much as to help us all to recognize that the central truths are the same wherever they are expressed. Some people may like food in the form of curry, others in the form of pasta, others in the form of mashed potatoes and peas, but they all want food. Some people like sweetness in the form of Swiss chocolate, and other people like it in the form of all-day suckers, and the others in the form of Häagen-Dazs ice cream. But they all like sweetness in one way or another. And in fact, I should just mention as a sideline, and you know these talks are informal, so if I get off the subject, so what else is new? But especially in these things, there was a couple who came here from Turin, Torino as they call it in Italy, and they were mentioning the chocolate from there, and I said, oh, you can't mention Turin chocolate compared to the Swiss. The Swiss is so much better. And she said, oh, that's just awful compared to the Turin. So anyway, I was really onto a good thing with that, because ever since then, every time they visit, they bring me some Turin chocolate, which in fact is very good. I'd say probably the best chocolates here are from Turin and Switzerland and Belgium. And depending on your mood at the moment, one is better than the other. But anyway, to come back to my point, we all like sweetness, we all need food, we all basically like kindness, peace, love, harmony, even though we express those things in different ways. And so human nature will express itself according to the cultural differences in a variety of ways, and yet human nature is not really that different. You find that underneath it all, I've often thought that if we were to find some distant planet with life on it, it wouldn't be that different from what we are. Why? Because everybody has an ego. And when you have an ego and you have a body, you're going to want things for the body and things for the ego, and it's all going to come back to the same old mess of pottage that we've got right here. I'm really convinced that there's no place in the universe that's worth bothering about, because it's always going to come right back to being stuck in a little body, like being in prison, stuck in this little ego, stuck in littleness, when the soul wants to reach out and expand. So just imagine a paradise with beautiful climate, wonderful birds everywhere, trees, lovely scenery, people all meditating and chanting to God, and all harmony, no anger, no negative emotions, no selfishness. It's still going to be limited. The very thought of going to paradise, going to a high astral planet, still seems so limiting compared to what we really want, which is omnipresence. That's what the spiritual path is all about. So, but then within that cultural context, we need to accept the basic differences and then try to go beneath them to this same understanding. And so with that thought, Babaji asked Sri Yukteswar to write a book that would help to explain the basic, the underlying similarity between the scriptures of the Vedas, of the Bhagavad Gita and so on, and the Bible, especially the Christian New Testament. And so Sri Yukteswar wrote this book, and it all seems a beautiful thing until you realize that this is a book that practically no one's ever going to read. It's an irony that it's... I used to think, well, gee, if Babaji really wanted him to show and to demonstrate the oneness of these scriptures, then is it really the Master's will that they do it in such a way that it might as well as be in Chinese? There aren't... obviously, there are many passages in the Holy Science that are easy to understand, but there are a lot also that are not. In fact, I remember a person saying, I was with Master, and this woman, Mrs. Carol Neely, her name was, she was there to edit, and I had mentioned that I found the book hard going, and she said, oh, I'm surprised, I find it easy. And she left the room, and Master turned to me with a wry smile, and he said, even I find it difficult to really get down into the deeper passages. But then I realized in thinking about this introduction that, in fact, it wasn't intended to bring the teachings out. It was to be seminal. It was to give the sort of basic points on which our masters and our teachers and so on could reach out further. This is really the job of the disciple. We have to, this is what I've tried to do with my life too. You see, here's the truth on one side of an abyss, and you have to reach over to the other side. One way is to simply say that those who are sincere will get those super microphones that will be able to pick up what you're saying. Another way is to broadcast it. A third way is to build a bridge. And in fact, what I've always seen in Master's writing, and even more in mine, because I'm even more coming down to the level where people are, you always have to sort of reach out to that level that you feel to talk to. Master was on a higher level and didn't feel to really explain things carefully. And in this respect, I think I've been helped in having been very full of doubts. I had lots, any question, any doubt that anybody could have, I'm sure I beat him to it. I'm sure I've had it. And so I can sort of put myself in the shoes of people who have all these questions and wondering, yes, but on the other hand, you know, that kind of intellectual doubts. Well, it's been good for me for two reasons. One is that I've overcome it. I don't have any of that now. But the other is that I can really understand where people are coming from who do have it and can help them. Well, to come back to the work that Master and our line of gurus has brought into the world, I see that it's really a process of development. Sri Yukteswar gave the seed. It was seminal. Then Master took that and explained it in greater depth. And what he did, in fact, I remember I was with him when there was a guest there, a professor from Columbia University, and he asked Master, why have you written on just the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, since you call your church a church of all religions? And Master's answer was very simple. He said, that was what Babaji wanted. This whole thing began with Babaji, and it began with Jesus' request to Babaji. Our job is to try to carry out the mission of the Masters and not just concentrate on what our particular guru did, because he was doing it on behalf of the Masters. Really, to understand Master and his mission is to understand Sri Yukteswar's mission, is to understand Lahiri Maharshmai's mission, is to understand Babaji's mission, and that commission that Christ gave him, that Jesus gave him, to bring these teachings to the West. Now, I say that because too often there is the tendency, for instance, Master started an organization, and the tendency is of many people to think, well, the organization is Master. But it is and it isn't. It is to the extent that it furthers this line of development. It isn't to the extent that it takes people's minds away from that line of development. To the extent that we, because we too represent as an organization legitimately, the line of gurus and their teachings, but if we start thinking that the organization of Ananda, just like the organization of Self-Realization Fellowship, or any other organization founded by our gurus, has a separate importance from that central mission, then we're really missing what they themselves have tried to promulgate, tried to bring into the world. It reminds me of one time Peggy Dietz, who Master told her to give Kriya to people if she felt they were ready. And she said, but sir, what would the organization say? Because they had their own guidelines. And he looked at her, he said, whom are you following, me or the organization? He drew a distinction between the two, because the organization was only one expression of what he was doing. It was not the final word. It was an important word, yes. Final word? No. He did not come to, as some people in SRF have said, that he came to start a monastery. Well, that's not all he came to do. He came to bring a teaching. He came to bring a teaching that would be for everybody. He came above all, of course, to bring Kriya Yoga. But he came also to show the underlying unity of the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, and through that, to show the unity of all religions. I used to wonder, well, why didn't he do what Swami Sivananda did, what Satchidananda did, what others have done also, in the name of teaching the oneness of religion, giving quotes from many religions. And I realized that that just becomes sort of a museum. It's too intellectual. You look at these different displays and you finally agree, well, yeah, I guess they said the same thing, and I guess he said the same thing, and it's all on this level. What you really need is to get beyond this level into a realization that there's an underlying truth. When you get to that, it doesn't really matter whether Lao Tse said it, or Buddha said it, or anyone else said it. It's the truth. It's convincing enough when you see that two of the greatest scriptures both said this. From there, you can easily understand that the message is that the truth is inside, not outside. Master said that the religion of the future will be self-realization. He did not mean Self-Realization Fellowship Church Incorporated. He meant the principle of self-realization. I said that once, and I was answered, that's your opinion. Well, I really can't understand or believe or accept that there can be another opinion on that. He did not talk organization. He talked non-sectarian truths. And that, I think, is Ananda's particular role, because there's so often been a tendency to think in terms of just the organization as Master's body, you might say, just as the Christians say that the church is Christ's body. I said to the local bishop here, I'm a Christian. He said, no, you're not. I said, well, it's for me to decide if I'm a Christian or not. He said, no, it isn't. I said, well, you tell me what you think a Christian is. He said, well, a Christian is somebody who accepts Jesus Christ as his only Savior and goes to confession and goes to Mass. Well, I go to Mass because I go inwardly into communion with God. To me, that's Mass. Inner communion is what communion is really all about. And I go to confession because I offer myself openly to God and say, here I am. I'm not trying to hide anything, and you show me what you want. But I remember I was in a church school, and it was an Episcopalian school. It was run by monks, though, in the Episcopalian church. And they had confession, and I think probably most of the boys went to confession. I never went. I never felt that I wanted to open my heart to these people, because I didn't feel that they had the wisdom to help me. And perhaps I was a little exaggerated in that way. When I was 5 years old, we were living, as you know, in Romania. And my mother didn't want to send me to a Romanian school, because after all, I was an American. So she tried home study. Well, I'm sure all you mothers and fathers will relate to this story, not on my side of the fence, but on my poor mother's side of the fence, because she said something to me quite simple, like, C-A-T is cat. And I looked at her coldly at 5 years old, and I said, and how do you know? You're not a teacher, you're just a mother. And I don't think that you would like if your child said that to you, but it does show something apart from arrogance in my idea that I wanted truth from somebody who I felt knew, who I felt was an expert. And I never felt that those monks could tell me anything, because I didn't see that they had anything. And it's like that story of the man in boot camp who was sort of wandering around picking up papers off the ground and looking at them and saying, this isn't it. And he'd pick up another paper, this isn't it. Finally they thought, well, this guy's got to go see the psychiatrist. So they had him go and see the psychiatrist, and this man was picking up papers off the desk and putting him down, this isn't it. This isn't it. That's all he'd say. So the psychiatrist recommended him very highly for a medical discharge. And he went to the officer, and as soon as the officer gave him his medical discharge, he looked at it, he said, "This is it," and he ran out. Well, when we get the right paper, we recognize it. And so, although I would never really accept anybody as whom I wanted to follow, the first words I addressed to Master were, "I want to be your disciple." And sometimes Daniel Boone and other people, for those who don't know the path, that name Daniel Boone may seem rather exaggerated, but I assure you it was in fact his name. He was one of the monks there. And he would tell me some pretty fanciful theories, and I always would ask him, "Did Master say that?" And if he didn't, then I wouldn't accept it because it didn't make any sense. But if he said, "Yes, Master said that," I would accept it, even if it didn't make any sense, because I assumed that it would make sense sooner or later. And sometimes I found that Master might have said something similar, but he hadn't quite got the point right. But always Master has been, through all these years, my point of reference, and I have never, and I think in this I have been different from a lot of people who have taught in his name even, I have never felt that I knew anything if it didn't totally agree with him. He's always been my focal point, my point of reference. I've always tried, anytime some idea has come to me that could this be true or could that be true, my first thought is, what did Master say? Does it endorse what seems to be true to me? If it doesn't, I discard it. I remember when I was working on that book, The Essence of Self-Realization, which was his sayings that I had recorded. I have a lot more, but I just chose those that would fit into a sequence in one book. And at one point there, I realized that the sequence needed a bridge. And of course, there were many things that I could remember him saying. And I tried for 2 days to remember something that he might have said that I could insert there as a bridge. And I couldn't remember anything, so I just had to leave it without. Because I don't believe for a moment that if Master didn't say it, it's for me to say it. That's not my job. My job is to try to represent him to the best of my ability. I don't say anything for that ability, but I do say that I can only be sincere to my own ability, and I can only do my best. That I have done. So anyway, Master came and brought this teaching to the West. You know, there was a very interesting exchange that happened one time, that Sri Yukteswar wasn't all that pleased with Master's writing in such a way, for example, as to show that these teachings are good for business. Sri Yukteswar was very much more into just being in samadhi and not bridging that abyss. And so he sort of expressed to Master, "Did you have to go that far out on a limb with these teachings to make them palatable?" And Master's answer pleased him. He said, "You are a goldsmith and you work with pure gold, but I am a jeweler and I have to add a little extra material to make the gold hard enough so I can shape it into jewels, into bracelets and necklaces and so on." And Sri Yukteswar understood, accepted it, and was happy with that answer. Well, that's what Master had to do. Basically, these teachings are certainly not to help people to become better businessmen. But on the other hand, if you're working with businessmen, and Sri Yukteswar didn't have to work with businessmen, Sri Yukteswar was even scattering disciples who came to him to the four winds. I asked Master one time, could it be that he knew that he wasn't coming back to this plane of existence and didn't want to take any more disciples? And Master said, yeah, that was what it was. He said he didn't want disciples. He just had a few stragglers in this lifetime, that's all. But Master had to try to reach out to those thousands and millions of people. And so he would try to put himself in their shoes, and he'd realize that if they can use their practice of concentration that they gain in meditation to become more successful in the things that are meaningful to them, then maybe they will try to go further into it. Master said, in fact, that's what the Vedas do. They give you all sorts of mantras and ceremonies and teachings to become successful in business, mantras that you can use to overcome your enemy in battle, mantras that you can use to have children, to attract a good mate. All these things are a part of the Vedas. And a purist reading the Vedas would say, well, after all, I want something spiritual. And that's what Swami Shankaracharya did. He pulled out from the Vedas those aspects that are totally non-dualistic. But the Vedas really are everything. And Master said that the reason they did it was that if you use a mantra to achieve success in business or whatever, then you will remember that it was a mantra that did it, not the Harvard Business College. And so you begin to think in terms of mantra, and you begin to think in terms of mental power. And as you think of mental power, it begins to make you think of going into that sort of factory of the mind, which is in your soul. And so bit by bit, many people who began, I remember a woman who came to my class in Sacramento, and she just took the yoga classes. This was back in the 60s, the yoga postures classes. And then when I gave the series again, she took the next series, in the first part of the evening, I would give the yoga postures, and then I'd have a break, and then we'd have the techniques on Raja Yoga and meditation. So she took the meditation course, and she said, you know, when I first took this course in the yoga postures, I did it only because I wanted to have something to talk about to my bridge club, and I thought it would be fun. But I find, you know, it's really very serious. And so she wanted to get into it further. Well, you see, you get people into it bit by bit. This is what Master meant by being a jeweler rather than a goldsmith. And we've got to bring this teaching out further to people. So my responsibility, you know, when Master told me, and it's curious because I've always believed that he wanted me to start communities. For one thing, when he gave that talk in Beverly Hills, and it was the strongest talk I've ever heard in my life, and he was saying, go north, see south, east, west, everywhere. Thousands of youths should take this teaching out to start self-sustaining world brotherhood colonies. And with so much power he spoke, and I was one of hundreds there, but as far as I know, I was the only one who really took it seriously. And that's partly I took it seriously because I had tried from the age of 14 or 15 to think, how could we start these things? I saw the need for them when I was even a teenager, and I got my friends interested by my enthusiasm until they saw that I was serious, and then they sort of all dropped off. I was still left there. But it was always a deep-seated interest of mine. And when he uttered that impassioned plea, I felt very deeply and vowed that I would do everything I could to fulfill that aspect of his mission. I wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been a part of his mission too. But he didn't tell me that. When he talked to me about my work in life, he said, your life is writing and lecturing. And I remember, sort of puzzled at the time, I said to him, but sir, haven't you already written everything that needs to be said? And he looked a little shocked. He said, don't say that. Much more is needed. And how then does Ananda come into the picture? How do the schools come into the picture? How do all the other things that I've done come into the picture? I realize that it's an essential part of the picture. because I couldn't write if I hadn't brought it down to a level of actual practice, tried it out, see if it worked. I couldn't have written on any of the things that I've written about if I hadn't tested it in the cold light of day. So Ananda was an absolute necessity for it. You know, Ananda's been a wonderful experiment, sort of a laboratory, where we have seen many hundreds of people coming, some going, some staying. And over the years, we've seen people living out their problems and their solutions. When you see one person, you don't get any clear picture. You can figure that it's due to his personality, it's due to his karma, it's due to all kinds of different things. But when you see many people trying in different ways to improve themselves, and nobody would come to Ananda if he weren't trying to improve himself, and you see it working for some and not working for others, you begin to notice that there is a thread of similarity not only in the results, but also in the cause. Those people, for example, at Ananda who have thought, well, I've got to get my trip together first and then I can think about other people, have never gotten their trip together. Those people who have thought in terms of their problems still have the same problems years later. Those people who think in terms of, well, I've got to find my happiness and then I can help other people to find happiness because if I'm not happy, what have I got to give anybody else, are not happy 10, 20, 30 years later. And again, the other side of the picture is those people who think in terms of how can I help other people? What are the solutions instead of dwelling on the problems? When they see that other people aren't doing right, or when they feel that they're not being treated right, instead of sitting there and brooding about it, they say, well, after all, that's their problem if they're not treating me right, but my problem is how do I take it? And they decide that they are happier if they respond in a charitable, supportive way. And why not be happy? Why allow yourself to fall into negativity? Why allow yourself to fall into resentment and bitterness and all those things? You're the one who suffers. They may not even know that you're feeling that way. But the point is that even if they are, and I've always felt that you need to take any kind of thought that you've got and take it to its final limit so you can see it clearly. So ask yourself this question. This is the sort of way I've approached these things. What if they are right? What if they really are prejudiced against you, biased against you, trying to keep you out of things so that you can't get a proper position in your work, don't appreciate you, all the thoughts that come to people. Finally speaking, the question arises, am I going to let them determine how happy I am? No. What does it matter what they think? That's their delusion, their problem. I choose to be happy. I choose to be kind. I choose to forgive. I choose to love. I've been, as you know, persecuted by my guru bhais, who somehow feel that they've called me Judas and all these things. They're the ones who are Judas. They betrayed me. I didn't betray them. Well, that's another story. But the point is, I just don't want to be under the thumb of their opinions. I know my guru. I know my relationship to him, and I know that basically they are good people, and so why should I sit here grumbling about how bad they are just because they don't treat me the way I think I ought to be treated? Maybe I need it. Maybe it's some of my karma. The point is that when we look at the people at Ananda who have decided that they are going to be positive, they're going to be loving and outgoing and forget themselves. This seems to be the final test of all. People who think in terms of themselves, they're always going to suffer in one way or another. People who don't think about themselves are always happy. And you'll see again and again, that's why I say that Ananda's been such a wonderful laboratory. Because you can see these human specimens, not in test tubes, but living it all out. And some of them are rising, and some of them are sort of grumbling along and bumping along, and other people are falling into ditches. And it all comes back to the same basic principles. Every one of those people, they come back to certain principles, which if they've tuned into well, nothing seems to faze them. They get stronger and stronger. If they tune into sort of, they sort of bump along, and sometimes they're up and sometimes they're down. If they tune into it, or if they're not in tune with it and fall out of tune with it, then they just sort of fall into a ditch, and they just become negative and full of anger and all the things that some people fall into. Now, mind you, even those people are good people, because they wouldn't have started this path if they weren't good. They wouldn't be wanting God if they didn't want to do something with their lives. They're fed up with just worldly lives. They're not bad people, but they've gotten off the track because they didn't get the right attitudes. I'm not going to be pointing the finger at anybody. I'm going to say that in myself and you, in yourself, we have to decide what will work best for us. Now, in my opinion, I think what works best for me is when I'm happy. And I'm happy when I'm not thinking about myself. I'm happy when I'm thinking about how can I help other people. I'm not happy when I think what's in it for me. When I'm thinking how can I help other people, that I am happy. How can I be, above all, a channel for other people? Because, you know, there's also a trap you can fall into, a do-gooder kind of thing, where I want to do this for you, I want to help people, I want to get the ego out of it altogether. Let God be the one who is doing it through you, but offer yourself up to Him, not passively saying, well, God, you tell me when you want to do it and I'll do it, until then I won't do anything. But do your best, and then try to ask Him to use you as a channel. You'll find that if your flow of energy is that way, then you grow. So Master came to the West to bring this sense of underlying unity. That was his mission. He started an organization not because he wanted to start an organization. He started the organization to help spread that mission. I remember Taramata saying to me one time, Master said that we are not a sect. Well, we are a sect. Well, so Master said one thing, she said another. Whom do we believe? I think that the thought of sectarianism is something that all religions get into all too easily. I don't want Ananda to fall into that trap. Ananda isn't important. SRF is not important. Truth is important. And so what Master came to bring were principles, not things. We tend to look at the expression and think that is the thing. The particular, you notice the Hare Krishna people, they adopt the Bengali accent of Prabhupada. Well, you don't become like Prabhupada by having a Bengali accent. You don't become like the guru from just behaving like him, picking up his mannerisms and so on. You don't become like the guru from thinking in terms of the things that he did outwardly. You try to tune into that spirit and then think, how can that spirit be useful and helpful to other people in new contexts? So I started Ananda really within the framework of what he said, that your work is writing and lecturing, because it helped to sort of concretize it. It helped to make it real and helped me to really know that I know what I'm talking about, because I've seen it work, and I'm not just up in the clouds with beautiful philosophical or theological theories. So these communities were a very important part of his mission, and I have been blessed to be able to serve in that way. The schools are also. But if you'll read all my books there, every one of them is trying to bring his central teaching out into practice, into daily life, to show how they affect every level of society. Well, I've written very seminally, also like Sri Yukteswar, but in another way. Mine are much easier to understand in the sense that they reach out to people where they are. But so many things in that, we need to keep on expanding it. It's like a river. If you have branches of the river, it can feed many fields. But if you say, well, the river's going in that way, I'm going to dig a hole and create my own river, then it isn't going to work. Or you might find a well, you might not, but you'll be doing a different thing. We will be in that flow and drawing on the blessings of the Masters if we try to continue in our attunement with the Masters as true disciples, realizing that to be a true disciple doesn't mean just quoting him. Certainly we want to quote him, but it doesn't mean just quoting in this way that a parrot would. You could teach a parrot all the right words, and it would recite all those right words along with saying, Polly want a cracker, and it wouldn't mean a thing to the parrot. You could play a record of the truths that Master taught, and that still doesn't mean anything. You have to have lived it, you have to know from your own experience that this is so, and that means applying it in your life and expressing it as you have lived it. So these teachings we need to bring out to the world in a real way. So what I have done, which is something, is still not very much. I can see thousands of different directions from this, not coming in and saying, oh, well, Kriyananda has written music, Kriyananda's writing books, I'll go out and write music and I'll write books, but not tuning into this ray, this flow. Discipleship means tuning into that flow and then carrying it out further. To me, the role of a disciple, and this is what I have tried to do with Master, is to see how can I express this teaching in ways to reach more and more people. There are millions of people who could come to this path, because everybody wants just what this path offers. They want something non-dogmatic. They want something real. They want something that's going to give them happiness, peace of mind, love. These things are universal. And Master gives it to them in ways that are very down to earth. We need to be able to present these teachings to all different levels of humanity in such a way that people can suddenly say, oh, is that what it's all about? Okay, and pick it up. That's what I did when I came upon the autobiography of a yogi. I had been skeptical of all religious teaching because I didn't really know that they knew. But I read that and it suddenly clicked. I said, ah, now I know. This I want to serve. Many times, different ones of you who teach have been able to put things in such a way that people say, oh, is that what you mean? You know, so often it happens that when people they disagree with you on some point. And if you listen to what's really going on, this is what Rajarshi used to do. He would be at the board meetings of big companies, and he'd listen to the board of directors sort of arguing back and forth on different issues. He'd just sit back and listen. He never got into the argument. Then he would, after hearing both sides, he would say, well, it seems to me what we are saying is such and such. And both sides would say, yes, that's right. So often people, even in apparent disagreement, are just disagreeing in the ways of expression rather than in the essence of it. If we can reach those points in our communication with other people that we do agree on, we find that suddenly they say, oh, is that what it's all about? Ananda's specialty is that, and I'd like to sort of build on that specialty, bridging the gap to reach out to people. There are many gaps, many banks on which people stand, reaching out to them, and that's your job. I can only do it according to my limited level of education, upbringing, personality, each one of us is limited by his, by the simple fact of his humanity. But I'd say one of the most beautiful things about Ananda is its great variety. The many different kinds of people that have come, the many different backgrounds, the many different interests, and each one of those can reach out to his own and help them to understand. So this teaching, which is a small thing in its origins, I think will reach millions, and Master said that it would. In Benares, when I saw first the balcony on which Lahiri Mahashaya taught the Bhagavad Gita, you'd think that there would be thousands listening. You know, that balcony was not big enough for even 15 people. It wasn't a big beginning, a few discriminating people. Master reached many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands. But our destiny is to reach millions. And I don't think we should think small. That's why when the colony leaders were here, and I talked of building our congregation, I said, let's think in terms of 1 million members. I don't mean members who sign on the dotted line and say, I'm a member of this particular force. No. But people whom we are willing to share with, we people who are willing to receive what we have to give. They don't have to sign that they're members, wear badges, and so on. They don't have to pledge that they will donate a certain amount. People who are willing to let us give to them, that's all I meant. But if they're open in that way, that they're willing to receive what we have to give, call them members. But I think that we can reach many that way. We tend to think small because our experience is small. We don't have to think that way. We tend to think, well, if we want to raise money to meet the needs of the lawsuits and all that, we have to go out there and talk to a few people. What? How many people are you going to talk to? Even if you had 1,000 people, that's not very many. We have the internet. We can reach people through that. I proposed to Dave Warner he get my radio programs on the internet 5 days a week for a whole year. It would be a wonderful way to reach people. But every one of you can reach out in some particular way if we understand that we're not just representing a little organization, a little place. We're not building Ananda by just getting a few more people at the expanding light. We're not building Ananda if we're even thinking in terms of numbers, although I've mentioned a number of 1 million people. But what we really will do to build Ananda is put out waves of the right kind of inspiration and love, and help people to remember that what we really want to do is not convert them to anything except their own higher self. That is something that everybody carries around with him. We don't want him to join this or join that. We want him to join himself to God. That's what yoga is all about. God bless you.